Chapter 16 Idol of the Hour. As his fate was debated in Washington that February, Grant continued to direct his department's operations from Nashville, where he lodged comfortably with a family that consists only of an elderly gentleman and his wife, son-in-law and his wife, besides a young school miss, Grant told Julia. I usually take a ride for an hour in the evening on horseback, or in the buggy. This, you know, always keeps me feeling well. He would not enjoy this tranquil interval for long. Grant felt ambivalent toward the congressional bill that would elevate him to lieutenant general and likely install him as chief of the Northern War effort. Conflicted about his own ambition, he nonetheless had a way of making himself available for promotion. Although he did nothing to advance the bill in Congress, neither did he do anything to stop it. He feared that becoming lieutenant general would snatch him from the battlefield and chain him to a desk, weakening his contribution to the war effort. He made clear that he would accept no post that tethered him to Washington or prevented him from leading armies in combat. Finding political machinations distasteful, Grant dreaded becoming a bureaucratic captive, mixed up in legislative intrigue. He also worried that as lieutenant general, he would suddenly outrank and supersede Halleck. Even though Halleck had been two-faced toward him, Grant still treated him with great respect and balked at leapfrogging over him in the military hierarchy. The one feature Grant wholeheartedly embraced was that promotion would boost his salary to $8,640 per year. On some level, he still feared a reversion to financial failure after the war. It came as no surprise that Grant's main cheerleader on the House floor was Elihu Washburn, who informed colleagues that Grant had captured more prisoners and taken more guns than any general in modern times. He cited Grant's modesty, lack of pretension, and devotion to the Union. There was some grumbling in Washington about Washburn's patent self-interest in promoting a man with whom he was so closely identified. Even his brother, Cadwallader, warned him he could be a bore and a monomaniac on the subject of Grant. Touching Ulysses S. Grant, I think you have crowded him about as hard as he will bear, and anything more looks fulsome. He's a good man, and we all know it, and we don't want to be told many times what we know already. In the Senate, James Doolittle led the charge for Grant, enumerating how he had won 17 battles, and taken 100,000 prisoners and 500 artillery pieces. Another persuasive argument for tapping Grant as lieutenant general was that it would topple Halleck, who was loathed by the more radical Republicans in Congress. Some legislators didn't want a specific name attached to the lieutenant general bill, fearing it would encroach on presidential prerogatives, setting a harmful precedent. While the version that passed the House contained Grant's name, the Senate excised it. Opposition to the bill centered on the idea that such a lofty rank should be conferred only after the Union won the war. As Congressman Thaddeus Stevens colorfully put it, "Saints are not canonized until after death." Everyone knew the sacred nature of the lieutenant general title, indelibly associated with George Washington. Congressman James Garfield worried that if the new lieutenant general failed in his assignment, he might have to be deposed a few months later, and noted that Lincoln already had full authority to name a new general-in-chief. Washburn pressed the argument that Grant, with a free hand, could wind up the war more quickly. "I want this now," the congressman insisted. "Grant must fight out this war, and he will never leave the field." To some extent, the drinking charges against Grant that passed through congressional corridors counted against him. Being an unknown entity to most legislators made him susceptible to damaging rumors about his pre-war history. As the commissary chief Michael R. Morgan explained, "The reason for Grant's resignation in 1854 was known. Grant's case was unusual at the time and was discussed by the Army. The prominent officers in the Eastern armies were mostly of the old army." Rawlins believed his vigilance in saving Grant from drink was an open secret in Washington, and those who knew it included Several gentlemen of great influence, who are to be found both in Congress and in the War Department, and belonging to both political parties. On February 26th, both houses of Congress agreed to a bill that followed the Senate's lead in expunging Grant's name. After Lincoln signed it 3 days later, he promptly named Grant to the position, perhaps believing promotion would neutralize a presidential rival. Events moved apace, the Senate confirming the appointment so swiftly that on March 3rd, Grant received a telegram summoning him to Washington to receive his new commission from the president's own hands. He had mastered the art of not grasping for power, but letting it come to him unbidden. Beyond satisfying his aversion to lobbying, this approach allayed the ingrained American fear of the man on horseback who might exploit his military laurels and turn tyrant after the war. As Lieutenant General, Grant knew, his life would whirl into an altogether different orbit. "Nothing ever fell over me like a wet blanket so much as my promotion to the Lieutenant Generalcy," he later confessed. The two men who knew Grant best, Rawlins and Sherman, dreaded his fate in Washington. They sensed that this guileless man could get sidetracked in the crooked paths of power. They had good reason to agonize over him. Grant's fame had been sudden, massive, a torrential rain after years of drought. It says much about Grant's character that at this moment of supreme triumph, instead of advertising his own virtues, he paid unstinting tribute to his colleagues, telling Sherman, "Whilst I have been eminently successful in this war, what I want is to express my thanks to you and McPherson as the men to whom, above all others, I feel indebted for whatever I have had of success." In a gracious reply, Sherman paid tribute to Grant. "You are now Washington's legitimate successor and occupy a position of almost dangerous elevation, but if you can continue as heretofore to be yourself, simple, honest, and unpretending, you will enjoy through life the respect and love of friends and the homage of millions of human beings that will award to you a large share in securing to them and their descendants a government of law and stability. I believe you are as brave, patriotic, and just as the great Washington, as unselfish, kind-hearted, and honest as a man should be. But the chief characteristic in your nature is the simple faith in success you have always manifested, which I can liken to nothing else than the faith a Christian has in a Savior. This faith gave you victory at Shiloh and Vicksburg." Sherman ended this warm-hearted letter with a stark warning that Grant should beware the perils of Washington, a plea from one Western man to another to avoid the insidious snares of the East. "Don't stay in Washington. Halleck is better qualified than you are to stand the buffets of intrigue and policy. Come out west. Take to yourself the whole Mississippi Valley. Here lies the seat of the coming empire, and from the west, when our task is done, we will make short work of Charleston and Richmond and the impoverished coast of the Atlantic." Rawlins wondered what would happen to his beloved boss in the rarefied atmosphere to which he now ascended. Telling his wife, "I grow dizzy in looking from the eminence he has attained and tremble at the great responsibility about to devolve upon him." He also mused darkly about his own medical future, confessing to Grant that he feared his health would require me to leave the service, that I should get no better when warm weather comes. Rawlins's military career had soared along with Grant's, and for the first time he worried they might have to part company. When he was named Brigadier General in the Regular Army on March 3rd, occupying the new post of Chief of Staff to the Commanding General, some senators groused about his lack of credentials. Rawlins thought the ruckus boiled down to a charge that "my military education is not such as to fit me for his Chief of Staff," and that the Brigadier rank should be reserved for field officers, not staff. Other senators thought it superfluous to have Rawlins as chief of staff in the field, since Halleck would enact this role in the Capitol. Refusing to discard him, Grant made a persuasive case for Rawlins's confirmation as brigadier general. General Rawlins has served with me from the beginning of the rebellion, he explained to Senator Henry Wilson. He comes the nearest being indispensable to me of any officer in the service. But if his confirmation is dependent on his commanding troops, he shall command troops at once. Having saved Grant from the bottle, Rawlins expected to be accorded special status in Washington. Testimonials to him invariably contained the code word indispensable. As Captain Eli Parker wrote to Washburn of Rawlins, his unwavering fidelity, judicious counsel, untiring energy, and inflexible integrity have no doubt contributed largely to the uninterrupted success of General Grant's armies. It is my opinion that he is absolutely indispensable to General Grant. Lieutenant Colonel William R. Rowley chimed in to Washburn. You know of how much importance I have always considered it to be to keep Rawlins with the general. It is unnecessary for me to particularize, as I have talked with you on the subject. Whether due to his guardian angel role or outstanding military judgment, Rawlins was confirmed as Brigadier General by the Senate on April 14th. On the morning of March 4th, 1864, Grant left Nashville for the nation's capital, accompanied by Rawlins and Cyrus Comstock, a West Point graduate who had become a trusted staff officer. It was a journey to a brand new existence for Grant, who could tell from crowds blossoming at train stations along the way that his life had changed in an almost inconceivable fashion. The general received a good deal of attention on the route, crowds waiting to see him at the depots, Comstock jotted in his diary. Grant did not yet fathom that his center of operations would switch irrevocably to the eastern seaboard. Within 2 weeks, he imagined he would be back commanding western armies. What he knew for certain was that he would remain a fighting general in the field. As he promised Sherman, I shall say very distinctly on my arrival in Washington that I accept no appointment which will require me to make that city my headquarters. En route, Rawlins maintained a proprietary scrutiny of his boss. One side of him was cheered by the hearty and enthusiastic manner in which varied people greeted Grant. But his deeply Puritan side descried a canker of corruption taking root in his pure-hearted boss. For all of Grant's humility, Rawlins perceived some tincture of vanity in him adored the adulation, however flustered he outwardly appeared. Grant never declined invitations to honor him and glowed before worshipful crowds. When they stopped in Louisville, Rawlins attended the theater with Grant and sat beside him in a private box. Back in his hotel room, he wrote a letter to his wife laced with mounting exasperation. During the performance, he said, I was supremely disgusted with the eagerness, or willingness, rather, of him we love to say is so modest and unassuming, to acknowledge the notice people are taking of him. In one who had less reputation for modesty, it would be pardonable. When Grant arrived in Washington in the late afternoon on March 8th, no official delegation greeted him at the train depot. Over his uniform, he wore a well-worn linen duster, soiled with western dirt. Besides Rawlins and Comstock, he was escorted by 13-year-old Fred. Hewing to military protocol, Grant called on Halleck in his office, discovered he was gone, then called at his Georgetown home, where he was also out. Having done his duty, Grant headed straight to the Willard Hotel. The last time Grant was in the Capitol, he was on the humble mission of trying to convince the War Department that he hadn't stolen the missing $1,000 as a quartermaster in the Mexican War. Now he confronted a sadder, busier Washington, reshaped by wartime exigencies. Churches and stables were enlisted as hospitals, while soldiers pitched their tents everywhere, even on the White House lawn. The city's sanitary conditions were atrocious, with the Potomac River degraded into a receptacle for sewage, spreading filth and disease whenever it overflowed. Soldiers trudged down muddy streets past the newly completed Capitol Dome and the unfinished Washington Monument, apt symbols of both the finished and remaining business of the war. Political life in Washington flowed through the thronged corridors of the Willard Hotel, down the block from the White House. Lincoln's secretary, John Hay, criticized the place as miraculous in meanness, contemptible in cuisine. But that was beside the point. Political deals were sealed in this watering hole. Office seekers and war contractors buttonholed legislators, and senators socialized over free-flowing whiskey. "Everybody may be seen there," Nathaniel Hawthorne observed. "You exchange nods with governors of sovereign states. You elbow illustrious men and tread on the toes of generals. You hear statesmen and orators speaking in their familiar tones." When Grant, short and shabby, entered the lobby of this haven for the city's power brokers, he brought into its elegant precincts the rough garb of the Western theater of war. He was known only by his rank and reputation, and few capital denizens had ever seen him in the flesh. Hence he and Fred created no stir as they slipped unnoticed into the hotel. Grant was an easy man for Easterners to patronize, and the desk clerk treated him with casual contempt, telling him a small top-floor room might be available. Unfazed, Grant said that would do, and signed the hotel register, U.S. Grant and Son, Galena, Illinois. When the clerk spun around the register and saw Grant's name, he changed on the spot from haughty to fawning, giving him Parlor 6, the most luxurious suite, where Lincoln had stayed prior to his inauguration. Once Grant and his son had stowed away their bags, they descended to the dining room, Grant clutching Fred's hand. For a few minutes, nobody recognized him, and then pandemonium erupted. "Ladies and gentlemen, the hero of Donelson, of Vicksburg, and of Chattanooga is among us," a congressman announced. "I propose the health of Lieutenant General Grant." Hundreds of diners cheered, stomped, twirled handkerchiefs, and banged knives on tables. Grant, who had never created a sensation like this, rose, looking very much astonished and perhaps annoyed, awkwardly rubbed his mustache with his napkin, bowed, and resumed his seat. So many people came over to grab Grant's hand and say hello that he scarcely had time to eat and finally gave up the attempt. As people gawked and gossiped, he must have realized he had shed his privacy forever. He and Fred fled the unwanted attention of the dining room. Many in the crowd commented on the celebrated newcomer. Richard Henry Dana, Jr., a well-known writer, attorney, and politician from Massachusetts, reacted snobbishly to Grant, as educated Easterners often did. He was disgusted by Grant's seedy appearance. "Grant had no gait, no station, no manner," Dana huffed. "He gets over the ground queerly. He does not march, nor quite walk, but pitches along as if the next step would bring him on his nose." He noted snidely that Grant had rather the look of a man who did, or once did, take a little too much to drink. Other spectators gave Grant a more searching look, spying hidden strength beneath the lackluster exterior. The renowned Shakespearean actor Edwin Booth grew enamored of the new lieutenant general. "Grant looks like the man he is, solid, true, and honest." Theodore Lyman, a young officer on General Meade's staff, described his appearance. "He is rather under middle height, of a spare, strong build, light brown hair and short, light brown beard. His eyes are of a clear blue, forehead high, nose aquiline, jaw squarely set, but not sensual." The hubbub at the Willard Hotel paled beside the glittering soiree that awaited Grant at the president's weekly reception at the White House. Having misplaced the key to his trunk, Grant wore the same grubby outfit in which he had traveled that day. Because one newspaper had announced he would attend the reception, the White House was packed with spectators, eager to snatch their first glimpse of Grant, who arrived around 9:30 p.m. He slowly worked his way toward the lanky president, looming distantly in the blue room. Lincoln had prepared for the meeting by studying a Grant portrait by John Antrobus that hung in the Capitol, showing him on Missionary Ridge in Chattanooga. It had been commissioned by Grant's friend, J. Russell Jones, who sent Antrobus there to sketch Grant in person. Horace Porter recorded the historic encounter between Lincoln and Grant. Lincoln recognized the general at once from the pictures he had seen of him. With a face radiant with delight, he advanced rapidly two or three steps toward his distinguished visitor and cried out, "Why, here is General Grant! Well, this is a great pleasure, I assure you," at the same time seizing him by the hand and shaking it for several minutes with a vigor which showed the extreme cordiality of the welcome. The two formed a strange pair. Lincoln, tall and rangy, loquacious, with countrified good humor, whereas Grant was small and self-contained, as taciturn as Lincoln was talkative. Porter noted the comical discrepancy in height. Grant's right hand grasped the lapel of his coat, his head was bent slightly forward, and his eyes upturned toward Lincoln's face. The president, 8 inches taller, looked down with beaming countenance upon his guest. Lincoln chatted alone with Grant for a while, then had Secretary of State William Seward shepherd him into the East Room, which broke into brisk applause and wave after wave of cheers. So boisterous did the gathering grow that Noah Brooks labeled it, "The only real mob I ever saw in the White House." The room shook in the throes of Grant mania. Because the crowd swallowed up the diminutive Grant, people twisted their necks to spot the bashful hero, chanting, "Grant! Grant! Grant!" Finally, at Seward's behest, Grant stood on a couch, enabling everybody to ogle the hero. "For once, at least," Brooks noted, "the president was not the chief figure in the picture. The little scared-looking man who stood on a crimson-covered sofa was the idol of the hour." The moment capped Grant's improbable progression since Fort Sumter. Never cut out for such social duties, a prisoner of this pandemonium, an embarrassed Grant admitted that the time he stood on the couch was the hottest campaign he ever fought. To Julia, he confessed, "I heartily wish myself back in camp." One reporter captured vividly the flustered Grant standing amid the hubbub. "He blushed like a girl. The handshaking brought streams of perspiration down his forehead and over his face." The war years hadn't improved Grant's social graces, but his gaucheness only heightened his appeal. "It indicated an absence of conceit, a lack of pretense," said an aide, "and a modesty almost unexampled in a man of his achievements." For an hour, Grant remained a captive of the adoring crowd before extricating himself to confer with Lincoln and Seward in a small dining room. Lincoln explained to Grant that at a brief ceremony the next day, he would formally bestow the Lieutenant General commission upon him. "The Secretary of War and yourself may arrange the time to suit your convenience," Lincoln said. "I am all ready whenever you shall have prepared your reply." Lincoln must have been startled when Grant retorted, "I can be ready in 30 minutes. They agreed upon 1 p.m. the next day. As a courtesy to Grant, Lincoln furnished him with a 4-sentence statement that he would read aloud to him the next day, enabling Grant to prepare his reply. Lincoln made 2 suggestions about Grant's response, both pertaining to the morale of soldiers and officers. Back at Willard's, Grant promptly scribbled his statement in pencil on a sheet of paper. Determined to establish his independence, he pointedly ignored Lincoln's 2 suggestions. Wary of pressure from Washington, he was bent upon resisting it from the outset. At the cabinet meeting the next day, the guests included John Nicolay, Halleck, Rawlins, Comstock, and Fred Grant. With deep feeling, Lincoln expressed what the lieutenant generalship signified. Reading aloud from a paper, he proclaimed, "With this high honor devolves upon you also a corresponding responsibility. As the country herein trusts you, so under God it will sustain you. I scarcely need to add that with what I here speak for the nation goes my own hearty personal concurrence." In response, Grant seemed visibly nervous. Fishing his speech from his pocket, He seemed to decipher his own handwriting with some difficulty. Then he straightened his spine, settled his nerves, and recited his statement with clarity. He was brief and self-effacing. With the aid of the noble armies that have fought on so many fields for our common country, it will be my earnest endeavor not to disappoint your expectations. I feel the full weight of the responsibilities now devolving on me, and know that if they are met, it will be due to those armies, and above all to the favor of that providence which leads both nations and men. Although Nicolay was disturbed that Grant hadn't heeded Lincoln's two suggestions, the president himself voiced no complaint, and when he introduced Grant to his cabinet, they almost all applauded. Afterward, Lincoln sat down with Grant for a strategy session, stating exactly what Grant wished to hear. He had never professed to be a military man, had no desire to meddle further in military strategy, and had done so reluctantly in the past. As Grant recounted, Lincoln said that he did not care to know what I was to do, only to know what I wanted, that I should have all I required. He wished me to beat Lee. How I did it was my own duty. He said he did not wish to know my plans or to exercise any scrutiny over my plans. So long as I beat the rebel army, he was satisfied. Lincoln greatly overstated the degree of his future detachment. Almost immediately, he unrolled a map of Virginia and pointed out in his curious, high, piping voice a path of attack lying between two streams that emptied into the Potomac. Grant responded candidly that if his army followed that direction, it would wind up in the mud or woods. The route was an impossible route and was never mentioned again by Mr. Lincoln, said Grant, who stressed that Lincoln and Stanton did everything in the world to assure my success. In his memoirs, Grant said he listened tactfully, but refrained from noting Lincoln's amateurish error. In short order, Grant had established his independence and taken full responsibility for the war's course. At the same time, he established a warm, cordial relationship with Lincoln, whose affable and gracious manners and humorous powers of mimicry pleased him. If Grant was in a hurry, Lincoln was equally impatient for results. He talked of his frustration with the whining, procrastinating generals who had tested his patience for years. Where Grant had hoped to make his headquarters out west, Lincoln emphasized the need for him to move east and rescue the sagging fortunes of the Army of the Potomac. He also stressed the urgent need for action. As Grant later quoted Lincoln, the government was spending millions of dollars every day, that there was a limit to the sinews of war, and a time might be reached when the spirits and resources of the people would become exhausted. Grant's swift, relentless military style would conform exactly to the president's desires. That night, Grant was invited to dine with Secretary Seward. Rawlins, zealous as ever, trailed him doggedly, seeing temptations for his boss lurking everywhere. "I shall accompany Grant, though it is not my pleasure to do so," he told his wife with a slight trace of martyrdom. "You know, where I am, wine is not drunk by those with whom I have any influence." The South understood the portentous meaning of Grant's promotion to lieutenant general. The North would have a fearless, aggressive commander who would ferociously exploit the North's full resources in manpower and materiel. "They say at last they have scared up a man who succeeds, and they expect him to remedy all that is gone," wrote the South Carolina diarist Mary Chestnut. Meanwhile, the North imposed correspondingly lofty expectations on Grant. Below a headline that blared, "We have found our hero," the New York Herald said Grant's advent materially strengthens our hopes that the great campaign about to open will substantially put an end to the rebellion. For Grant, the first order of business on March 10th was to visit the troubled Army of the Potomac, headquartered at Brandy Station, southwest of Washington, near the town of Culpeper, Virginia. That army's commander, George Gordon Meade, was temporarily grounded with a cold, So when Grant arrived in a driving rain, he was met at the train station by Meade's chief of staff, Andrew Humphreys. As Grant knew, the Army of the Potomac brimmed with suspicion of him as a newcomer, a Westerner, and an outsider, and Humphreys expected to take an instant dislike to him. Instead, Grant won him over handily, Humphreys informing his wife that Grant was good-looking, with an intellectual face and head, which at the same time expresses a good deal of determination. Meade showed respect for Grant by having a Zouave regiment with red fezes and exotic flowing trousers salute him as a band struck up martial airs. The tall, slim Meade strode from his tent, eyed Grant beneath a slouched felt hat, and gave him a friendly handshake even before Grant dismounted. The two men had last met during the Mexican War, when they were both young lieutenants. In many ways, George Gordon Meade was the antithesis of Grant. A patrician figure from Philadelphia, fluent in French, he had graduated from West Point and was well-versed in military literature. With a gaunt, sallow face, bald pate, and graying beard, he had bags drooping below eyes that bulged behind oversized spectacles. Meade was forever jealous of his reputation. Thin-skinned and cantankerous, he seldom enjoyed calm moments and grew easily upset, spluttering with ungovernable rage whenever his pride was injured. This led to his nickname, the old goggle-eyed snapping turtle. And it wasn't meant affectionately. His battlefield style was frenetic. He would explode with colossal energy, curse a blue streak, then pace with fury behind the lines. No man, no matter what his business or his service, approached him without being insulted in one way or another, Charles Dana wrote, and his own staff officers did not dare to speak to him unless first spoken to, for fear of either sneers or curses. Meade later became notorious among the press corps when he seized a reporter who had criticized him, hung a scurrilous sign around his neck that said, "Libeler of the Press," placed him backward on a mule, and ran him out of camp. For all his flaws, Meade was a competent commander and an experienced professional, and was recognized as such by his peers. When apprised the year before that Meade had taken command of the Army of the Potomac, Robert E. Lee reacted respectfully, saying, "Meade would commit no blunders on my front, and if I make one, he will make haste to take advantage of it." Still, his failure to pursue Lee after Gettysburg revealed that Meade was not a bold, enterprising leader in the mold of either Grant or Lee. Once Grant and Meade were seated in the latter's tent, they lit cigars and got down to business. Grant sized up Meade well, acknowledging his bravery and loyalty while noting his temperamental outbursts. "No one saw this fault more plainly than he himself," Grant wrote, "and no one regretted it more. This made it unpleasant at times, even in battle, for those around him to approach him, even with information." While Grant imagined at first that he would oust Meade, he needed to win over the goodwill of the skeptical Army of the Potomac and didn't want to appear high-handed. Many people had warned Grant he would be surrounded by backbiting jealousy in the East. "I have just come from the West," Grant noted, "and if I removed a deserving Eastern man from the position of Army commander, my motives might be misunderstood, and the effect be bad upon the spirits of the troops." Meade knew Grant might replace him with his own man, especially since Grant was indoctrinated with the notion of the superiority of the Western armies and that the failure of the Army of the Potomac to accomplish anything is due to their commanders. Nonetheless, Grant showed an open mind. As the two men chatted, Grant was hugely impressed with Meade's self-effacing manner, saying he understood if Grant wished to replace him with a Western officer close to him. Meade offered his resignation, arguing that the cause should take precedence over personal feelings. Grant was struck by his exemplary character. "He spoke so patriotically and unselfishly that even if I had had any intention of relieving him, I should have been inclined to change my mind after the manly attitude he assumed in this frank interview." On the spot, Grant asked Meade to retain command of the Army of the Potomac, and said he would appoint Phil Sheridan to take over the cavalry, with Sherman leading the Western armies. Grant chose an unorthodox arrangement with Meade. He would make his headquarters in the field and travel with the Army of the Potomac, while Meade would remain, at least nominally, in command of the Virginia force. Grant would issue broad orders, leaving detailed execution to Meade. It was an awkward situation, with Meade operating in Grant's shadow, but it obtained for Grant the dawning respect of the Army of the Potomac. Grant always felt vindicated in his decision to retain Meade. Meade was certainly among the heroes of the war, and his name deserves all honor. Under this harsh exterior, Meade had a gentle, chivalrous heart, and was an accomplished soldier and gentleman. The two men would have an excellent, though not flawless, working relationship. Grant disarmed people's expectations with his interpersonal skills. If he did not overflow with charm, neither did he ruffle people's feathers or threaten them with rivalry. If needed, he could handle people as delicately as he did his horses, and this formed a major part of his military success as he assembled the team of people required to end the war. Meade had gone into the meeting somewhat dubious about Grant. During the Mexican War, he had found Grant a clever young officer, but nothing extraordinary, and not particularly well-educated. He was acquainted with the dark side of Grant's history, recalling how Grant had been compelled to resign some years before the present war owing to his irregular habits. He condescendingly attributed Grant's success to indomitable energy and great tenacity of purpose, not subtlety of mind. Now Meade discovered new virtues in this somewhat clumsy, reticent man. "I was much pleased with Grant," he told his wife. "You may rest assured he is not an ordinary man." He did detect one critical, lifelong failing in Grant, a simple and guileless nature that placed him under the influence of those who should not influence him, and desire to do so only for their own purpose. After this flying visit to Brandy Station, Grant returned to Washington, where he spurned an invitation from the president to attend a fancy dinner in his honor, followed by a performance of Edwin Booth in Richard III. Grant explained that he was anxious to set off for the West and put his military plans in motion. "We can't excuse you," Lincoln insisted. "Mrs. Lincoln's dinner without you would be Hamlet with Hamlet left out." Tactful but firm, Grant reminded Lincoln that time was important and that the dinner would mean $1 million lost to the country. "And really, Mr. Lincoln, I have had enough of this show business." Lincoln cordially bowed to his decision, perhaps secretly delighted by a general-in-chief so eager to finish the war. By the time he left for Nashville the next day, Grant had started to reconfigure the upper echelons of the war effort, crafting a modern command structure. Halleck was demoted to Army Chief of Staff, while Sherman would head the Military Division of the Mississippi, and McPherson the Department and Army of the Tennessee. Lincoln did not regret seeing Halleck taken down a peg. He wasn't the enterprising commander he had expected, but had shrunk from responsibility whenever it was possible, Lincoln complained. Probably relieved by the change, Halleck now found his ideal position, bound to his desk and thrust into an advisory role where he could shield Grant from Washington intrigue, free him from tedious paperwork, and provide a crucial liaison with Lincoln. He would also relay Grant's orders to 19 departmental commanders. Instead of bypassing Halleck, Grant made him the conduit for communications with Stanton and the administration. After a sometimes bumpy past, Grant and Halleck now developed a superb partnership. Halleck had excellent analytic powers and gave Grant invaluable intelligence about the political calculations of Lincoln and Stanton. He was deferential to Grant while reserving the right to register dissent. In Grant's later view, Halleck was loyal and industrious, sincerely anxious for the success of the country, and without any feeling of soreness at being superseded. The new structure was so well ordered by Grant that Lincoln could finally step back a bit from military matters. When Grant arrived in Nashville on March 14th, Sherman greeted him soberly. "I cannot congratulate you on your promotion. The responsibility is too great." While there, Grant received the War Department order that officially made him commander of the armies of the United States, his headquarters in the field. His decision to make Sherman chief of the entire Western Army was a daring one. Sherman had not yet attained his later celebrity, or notoriety, and his selection wasn't an obvious choice. Grant's new aide, Adam Badeau, recalled Sherman as tall, angular, and spare, sandy-haired, sharp-featured, his nose prominent, his lips thin, his gray eyes flashing fire as fast as lightning on a summer's night, his whole face mobile as an actor's. No one could be with him half an hour and doubt his greatness, or fail to recognize the traits that have made him world-renowned. In Nashville, Grant met with the talented commanders who would be instrumental in winning the war: Sherman, McPherson, Sheridan, Rawlins, Dodge, and Logan. Over the next couple of days, Grant laid out the broad strokes of his general strategy, which called for applying maximum pressure simultaneously to Robert E. Lee and Joseph Johnston so they could not rush aid to each other. The Western commanders were hungry for scuttlebutt about the Army of the Potomac, and Grant assured them it was the finest army he had ever seen, far superior to any of ours in equipment, supplies, and transportation. But he also told them of an army cowed by the overblown specter of Robert E. Lee. He said that the officers told him, "You have not faced Bobby Lee yet." And as he said it, Grenville Dodge noted, "I could see that twinkle in Grant's eye that we often saw there when he meant mischief." Grant's Nashville stay allowed time for a statehouse meeting with Governor Andrew Johnson and a theater trip to see Hamlet. The audience was noisy, and Sherman, an avid theatergoer, complained how the actors were butchering the text. In the graveyard scene, when Hamlet performed his soliloquy over Yorick's skull, one soldier hollered, "Say, pard, what is it, yank or rib?" This led to such tumult that Grant and his associates left the theater to dine on oysters in a local restaurant. Another comic scene ensued when Galena's mayor arrived to present the ceremonial sword to Grant from the citizens of Joe Davis County. The folks of northern Illinois were eager to claim him, notwithstanding his brief one-year residence in Galena. Grant stood ill at ease during the presentation. At its close, the mayor handed him a parchment covered with resolutions in his honor, passed by the Galena City Council. Grant, who had written out his reply, could not locate it, no matter how hard he searched. An amused Sherman said Grant began to fumble in his pockets, first his breastcoat pocket, then his pants, vest, etc., and after considerable delay he pulled out a crumpled piece of common yellow cartridge paper, which he handed to the mayor. The speech was, in Sherman's view, excellent, short, concise, and if it had been delivered by word of mouth, would have been all that the occasion required. The moment illustrated that if the naive Grant lacked polish, he already had finely tuned political instincts, the product of native intelligence. When Grant departed for Washington, Sherman accompanied him, but they had to shout at each other to be heard above the train's din. As a result, when they reached Cincinnati, they took a room at the Burnett House, posted a guard at the door, unfurled maps, and formulated military policy. The strategy Grant laid out envisioned assaults on enemy armies, not cities or territories. "He was to go for Lee, and I was to go for Joe Johnston," Sherman wrote. That was his plan. They also discussed the operation that would win Sherman lasting fame, his march on Atlanta. Then Sherman retraced his steps westward to Nashville, and Grant continued eastward. Years later, standing outside the hotel, Sherman waved his hand toward it and declared, "Yonder began the campaign." Before leaving Cincinnati, Grant took time to visit his parents in Covington, Kentucky. His father sent a carriage to the train station, but the driver, expecting someone magnificent, did not spot Grant. As a result, Jesse was startled to see his son alone padding up the path to the house, toting his carpet bag, attired in a plain army coat. Hannah Grant had reacted to the Civil War with religious fervor, convinced the Lord had chosen her son for a purpose. She had only one concern. How would her son fare against the toughest Southern general? Was he afraid to attack Lee? "Not at all," Grant assured her. "I know Lee as well as he knows himself. I know all his strong points and all his weak ones. I intend to attack his weak points and flank his strong ones." During Grant's stay, a highly unlikely story made the rounds that he was drunk, and Jesse insisted to a reporter that his son had not drank a drop of liquor in 10 years except a very small quantity on one occasion by order of a physician. On March 22nd, Grant spent the day in Philadelphia and dropped by the Continental Hotel, where he met General Delos B. Sackett, who was about to travel west as an army inspector. His friend E.D. Keyes, seated at the table, recorded a telling comment by Grant. "We conversed pleasantly on various subjects, and when I offered to fill a glass with champagne for him, the general placed his hand over his glass, saying, 'If I begin to drink, I must keep on drinking.'" The same day this conversation occurred, Isaac N. Morris, a former congressman from Illinois, published an unsigned biography of Grant in the Nashville Intelligencer, boosting him as a presidential prospect. 2 months earlier, Grant had written to Morris and explicitly disavowed presidential ambitions, but Morris refused to heed his word and proudly sent copies of the newspaper to Grant, his parents, and his friends in Ohio and Missouri. The next day, Grant reached Washington in the company of Julia, who suffered from an eye infection, and 6-year-old Jesse. The other children still boarded with Harry and Louisa Boggs in St. Louis. Grant received the treatment befitting a newly coined celebrity when he and Stanton visited the photographic studio of Matthew Brady. With his curly hair and wire-rimmed spectacles, Brady had pioneered in battlefield photography. After seating Grant directly beneath a skylight, he ordered his assistant to climb up and remove a covering that blocked the fading sunlight of late afternoon. When this colleague slipped, his feet crashed through 2-inch-thick glass panes, sending a drizzle of sharp fragments around Grant, who, according to Brady, gazed up slowly with a barely perceptible quiver of the nostril. His coolness struck the photographer as the most remarkable display of nerve I ever witnessed. Turning white, Stanton trembled to think what might have occurred had Grant perished. "Not a word about this, Brady, not a word," he exclaimed. "You must never breathe a word of what happened here today. It would be impossible to convince the people that this was not an attempt at assassination." Brady snapped a perceptive photograph of Grant, leaving the upper third of the canvas bare, and placing his subject slightly below the picture's center, accentuating his short stature. There was no strutting, no bombast, no false bravado. Grant sat with one arm resting on a table, his hand dangling in the air, while the other hand curled loosely into a fist. His hair was swept back carefully, his beard relatively well trimmed. He had been posed with a somewhat stiff, upright carriage, but his pale, sad eyes seemed to brood over years of military casualties. As Grant moved about Washington, he was mobbed by crowds elated to catch a glimpse of him. He knew his promotion would tie him to Washington for a long time, scuttling plans to move to the Pacific coast someday. "General Grant is all the rage," Senator Sherman reported to his brother William. "He is subjected to the disgusting but dangerous process of being lionized. He is followed by crowds and is cheered everywhere." The senator feared the pure-hearted Grant would be spoiled by fulsome flattery. William defended Grant from such insinuations, even though he experienced similar fears. "Grant is as good a leader as we can find," he wrote back. "He has honesty, simplicity of character, singleness of purpose. and no hope or claim to usurp civil power. Don't disgust him by flattery or importunity. Let him alone. Shortly after returning to Washington, Grant established his headquarters in the field at Culpeper Courthouse and quickly prepared for the upcoming campaign against Lee. One of his first orders was to commission a map from Halleck showing with red lines the front occupied by Union forces at the start of the war and at present, while an ambitious blue line marked the territory he planned to occupy. As he labored, he was invited to attend a White House reception with Julia, but too engrossed to go, he dispatched Julia and Admiral Farragut instead. In many ways, Julia Grant was more worldly and socially adept than her husband, and could tutor him in the elevated circles in which he now traveled. She knew the intense scrutiny he would undergo and worked hard on his appearance. As Badeau wrote, "With a feminine insight, she comprehended both the petty craft and the important ambitions that underlie so many of the ceremonies of official life at Washington as well as in aristocratic capitals." Badeau escorted her to the White House and recounted how on the receiving line Lincoln overlooked her name until Badeau repeated more loudly, "Mrs. General Grant, Mr. President." At that point, the tall, ungainly man looked down upon his visitor with infinite kindness, beaming from his ugly, historic face, then placed both his hands on Mrs. Grant's and welcomed her more than warmly. When Lincoln asked where her husband was, Julia answered with studied diplomacy, "I begged the general to remain and accompany me, but he said he must go to the front, and he was sure the president and Mrs. Lincoln would excuse him." Julia championed her husband unapologetically. When a group of ladies asked whether he would take Richmond, Julia replied, "Yes, before he gets through. Mr. Grant always was a very obstinate man." Every week, Grant traveled to Washington and sat down with Lincoln and Stanton for lengthy talks. Almost immediately, he developed a harmonious working relationship with the president. That Lincoln felt perfectly compatible with Grant politically was demonstrated one evening when an Illinois visitor alluded to party operatives pushing Grant for president. Lincoln replied, "He is fully committed to the policy of emancipation and employing Negro soldiers, and with this policy faithfully carried out, it will not make much difference who is president." Grant was profoundly influenced by Lincoln, who buttressed his idealism and his view that slavery was fundamental to the Union fight. "There had to be an end of slavery," Grant later explained. "Then we were fighting an enemy with whom we could not make a peace. We had to destroy him." By this point in the war, Lincoln looked haggard and woebegone. His high forehead, dark hair, high cheekbones, and long chin made his appearance as unforgettable as Grant's was nondescript. With his ever-flowing fund of yarns, Lincoln might have seemed unlike Grant, but Grant, too, could be a wry, charming storyteller. Lincoln was more openly driven than the sometimes indolent Grant, displaying an irrepressible ambition and lifelong thirst for learning as he strove to feed his eager mind. Lincoln and Grant shared much common ground. They were both Westerners, awkward in their movements, rough and uncouth in manners. Both had domineering fathers and ambitious wives. Both had married into slaveholding families that evinced insufferable conceit about their standing in the world. Both were fastidious and had grown up refusing to hunt or swear. Lincoln also eschewed tobacco, alcohol, and gambling. These two prairie figures also suffered the condescension of top-lofty Easterners. Criticism of Lincoln took a peculiarly harsh tone, editorial writers ridiculing him as a coarse country fellow. He had grown up in deeper poverty than Grant, but had attained more security. Nevertheless, before succeeding as an attorney and a politician, he had bounced from job to job, serving as a riverboat man, store clerk, and blacksmith, a checkered past that made him loyal to people who had faltered in life. Even in the 1850s, Lincoln sometimes arrived in his law office wrapped in impenetrable gloom. Afflicted by nightmares, seized by periodic depression, he had an innate melancholy that contrasted sharply with his moods of uproarious mirth. While Lincoln seemed more extroverted than Grant, appearances could deceive. At heart, he was enough of a loner that his friend David Davis called him the most reticent, secretive man I ever saw or expect to see. Lincoln was fascinated, if somewhat bemused, by Grant, whose unpretentious style he appreciated. He'd had his fill of egomaniacal generals, professional braggarts and blowhards such as McClellan and Hooker. One day, Lincoln's secretary, William O. Stoddard, found his boss stretched out on a sofa and asked for his impressions of Grant.
"Well, Stoddard, I hardly know what to think of him altogether. I never saw him myself until he came here to take command. He is the quietest little fellow you ever saw, makes the least fuss of any man you ever knew. I believe two or three times he has been in this room a minute or so before I knew he was here. The only evidence you have that he's in any place is that he makes things git. Wherever he is, things move."
Lincoln's one early brush with military service came briefly as a militia captain during the Black Hawk War of 1832, when, he admitted, he fended off more mosquitoes than bullets. After the firing on Fort Sumter, Lincoln had undertaken a crash course in the art of warfare, borrowing military manuals from the Library of Congress and staying up late to devour them. He also studied reports from the field and quizzed every general and admiral he could find. The miracle was that Lincoln ended up a fine military strategist who was, in many ways, superior to the chief generals who preceded Grant. Not only was he free from West Point dogma, but he wasn't beholden to generals from the old regular army. His military sagacity was a triumph of native intelligence and supreme willpower. Lincoln had developed operating theories that dovetailed perfectly with Grant's views: that the Union Army should destroy Confederate armies, not take cities or territory; that it should exploit its massive resources by simultaneous attacks against the enemy across many fronts; that military decisions were inseparable from political goals; and that only one final, savage, protracted burst of fighting could end the conflict. The Lincoln whom Grant met in March 1864 was a more mature military thinker than the callow, fumbling president of April 1861, and fully prepared for the remorseless warfare patented by Grant, Sherman, and Sheridan. Lincoln was smart enough to see that he and Stanton had been forced to act as armchair generals, second-guessing military leaders in the field, whereas now was the time to recede.
"You and I, Mr. Stanton, have been trying to boss this job, and we have not succeeded very well with it," Lincoln said. "We have sent across the mountains for Mr. Grant, as Mrs. Grant calls him, to relieve us, and I think we had better leave him alone to do as he pleases."
Grant was the antithesis of everything Lincoln had deplored in his predecessors, as eager to fight as they were reluctant, as self-reliant as they were dependent, as uncomplaining as they were petulant. Grant did not badger or connive for more troops or scapegoat others. There would be no more grumbling from Lincoln about dilatory generals as Grant converted the Union Army into a scene of ceaseless activity. With his zest for combat, Grant was itching for a fight. Lincoln felt a huge weight lifted from his shoulders. When William O. Stoddard asked whether Grant was the man to embolden the Army of the Potomac, Lincoln pointed his long forefinger at him and exclaimed,
"Stoddard, Grant is the first general I've had. He's a general. You know how it has been with all the rest. As soon as I put a man in command of the army, he'd come to me with a plan of campaign and about as much as say, 'Now I don't believe I can do it, but if you say so, I'll try it on,' and so put the responsibility of the success or failure on me. They all wanted me to be the general. It isn't so with Grant. He hasn't told me what his plans are. I don't know, and I don't want to know. I'm glad to find a man who can go ahead without me."
By now, Grant had piled up so many victories that any lingering pre-war insecurity had vanished, and he wasn't fazed by the vast power delegated to him. He and Lincoln developed a deep mutual trust that transcended petty egotism or rivalry. Grant was not only the most competent of Lincoln's generals, but the most trustworthy, following no covert agenda. "I was never interfered with," Grant reminisced. "I had the fullest support of the President and Secretary of War. No general could want better backing, for the President was a man of great wisdom and moderation, the Secretary a man of enormous character and will." The pieces were now in place for a gigantic turn in the direction of the stalemated Eastern War.